Alright, it is now 5 o'clock on Monday, March 6th. I'm going to go ahead and call the City of Columbia Council work session to order. And we have a staff presentation. I don't know who's kicking it off.
I think I'm kicking it off.
So, I'm Erin Keyes, the Acting Assistant Director for Electric. I have Larry Feltner with me from the Prime Group. And we're here to talk about the cost of service study for electric utility. So just a few brief points before Larry gets into, you know, more about how the study came about and some of the details. Just to kind of go over our goals. Obviously, we want to ensure the long-term financial health of the utility and its infrastructure. As staff, we regularly develop our own financial forecasts and make adjustments to the budget from year to year. But to provide long-term stability, we typically have a cost of service study anywhere from 5 to 8 years to ensure we're appropriately recovering our costs through our rates. And so that's what this is about. We've hired a consultant to help us appropriately recover our costs through rates. So our other goals are we need to improve our bond rating for water and electric. Just a reminder, by charter, water and electric are one department. So our bond rating is judged over both departments. We found out in about the last 10 days that our debt coverage ratio for fiscal year 2022 was 0.79. Our bond covenants require a 1.1 debt coverage ratio. So this low debt coverage ratio is likely due to the large mid-year appropriation that happened last year to cover our power purchase costs when power purchase was very volatile last year. So we had that more than $30 million rate appropriation last year. A rate adjustment will help us address this debt coverage. Another goal is to account for that volatility in power purchase costs and to recover those costs by updating our power cost adjustment method that's in the ordinance. So just real brief, to give you some background. So this work started in 2018 with the Integrated Electric Resource Master Plan. This company was hired by that task force to do this work. Many detailed decisions and things have happened since 2018. So please keep that in mind. It's been a long process. But sometimes some decisions were based on like 2019 information for our budgets. Some information is based on 2021 information for our budgets. So keep that in mind. The Water and Light Advisory Board has been making an instrumental in guiding this process and making a lot of those decisions. Decisions about renewable energy rates and how that relates to the rate structure, fairness between classes, our CIP, just a few things that there's been many, many discussions around to get to the point that we're at today. So just so you're aware. There's been a lot of significant changes in our economy since 2018. The biggest is the 8% inflation rate last year. And again, we had a major mid-year appropriation last year, more than $30 million. That is not usual. So far this year, our power purchase costs have not been that extreme, but we don't know what the future holds, so we need to account for that. These are our rate adjustments for the last 15 years. If you do a cumulative total, it's about 25%. There's an average of about 1.68% annually. You can see the last 4 years, there's not been a rate adjustment. And just briefly, Larry's gonna go more into this, but this cost of service, we're basically asking, how much do we need to have a financially healthy utility, who do we get it from, and how do we collect it? So how much will it cost to maintain the services that our customers expect and to meet our financial targets? That's our revenue sufficiency or revenue requirement piece. From who do we recover these costs? That's a defensible and repeatable method for determining how much it costs to provide our residential services, how much it costs to provide commercial industrial services. So that is our cost of service, from whom. And then how do we collect the revenue? We want to collect it proportional to the services and provide stability to appropriately cover what we need. And that's our rate design. So how much, from whom, and how to collect. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Larry, and he's going to get into more details on those, what those mean.
Okay. I'm going to try to give you, you know, a little background about the process that we go through, as well as the results, so that you hopefully have a little better understanding of how we got to where we're, to what we're proposing. So when we do a rate study, there's really three steps that we go through. We do a cost of service study. We do or determine a revenue requirement. And then we try to design rates that get us that revenue requirement. And we try to design those rates as practical as we can in a fair way. In other words, at the root of all this process is really fairness. And cost of service studies themselves, they were created by regulatory bodies over decades because they're charged with implementing fair rates. So the cost of service study itself is a fairness tool, is what it is. It's not really an economics tool as much as it is a fairness tool.
Can you tell me, is there a difference between the cost of service and the revenue requirement?
Yes, the cost of service study is a cost study that looks at each rate schedule that the utility has, and it compares the revenue that each class generated with the cost to provide service. So it looks at each class and it says, is this class generating enough revenue to cover the cost that it creates on the system? The revenue requirement is how much money does the electric utility need.
And so what does that include?
That includes all of your costs plus financing and quote unquote margin. In other words, margin is probably not the best term to use because those retained earnings ultimately get used to pay for infrastructure and stuff, but it includes 100% of your out-of-pocket costs, purchase power, O&M expenses, administrative and general expenses, and you've got to fund your CIP as well.
Okay.
So it's all of that.
Okay.
Make sense?
No.
Okay. So the methodology that we use in the cost of service study, just so you know, is not the prime group's methodology, or it's not my methodology. It is what's called NARUC methodology, which is the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners. They publish what's called an electric cost allocation manual, and it explains appropriate methodologies to perform a cost of service study. So it's an industry standard approach to doing a cost of service study. And in theory, if another person performed the same study with the same test year using the NARUC methodology, they should get the same or very similar results. Okay, so it's an unbiased approach to doing the study. And the study itself uses, and I hope I'm not getting more detailed than you really want, but it's a three-step process. We go through what's called functionalization, classification, and allocation when we do the study. And the bottom line, if you don't remember anything else I say today, this bottom bullet point is probably the most important thing, and that ultimately what you're trying to do with a rate study is you're trying to create rates so if a customer causes the utility to incur a cost, that customer pays those costs through the rates that we charge. So that's ultimately what we're trying to get to. That's the whole point of the process. So it's all about what's fair, okay? So what functionalization, classification, and allocation, what that looks like is this. So we start with all the utilities' costs, and then we organize those costs by what kind of costs they are. Is it purchase power? Is it line transformers? Is it meter reading and billing? Is it distribution primary? There's a whole lot more categories than what we show here. And then the second step, classification, is, okay, what causes that particular cost to be incurred? Does it vary with the number of customers that we have to serve? Does it vary with the amount of energy that we sell? Or does it vary with some kind of demand, like distribution capacity, purchase power demand, that kind of thing, okay? So basically, functionalization and classification is organizing the accounting data in a logical way so that you can then allocate it to each rate schedule in a logical way. And those allocators end up relating to how it's classified. So if it's a customer cost, it gets allocated on the number of customers in the class. If it's an energy-related cost, it gets allocated on how many kilowatt hours a class buys. So it's a very logical, straightforward process. And these are the results from that process. So this, I don't know how many of you are familiar with an income statement, but it's a little like an income statement. So this is the revenue each rate schedule. These are the rate schedules. This is the revenue each rate schedule generated. These are the operating expenses that we allocated to each rate class through that process. And this is the margin that each class generated. You'll notice some are negative, some are positive. Rate base is the investment in facilities on the system. So it's the lines, the poles, the transformers, it's all that stuff. It's the investment to serve customers' electricity service. And this return on rate base is simply return on investment. In other words, it's margin divided by rate base. So it's very simple, straightforward calculation. So what this tells you is that you have some classes that aren't covering the cost with the rate that they pay for the expenses that they cause the utility to incur, and some are. And I'll go on. We're going to talk a little bit, and I'll come back to this.
So rate base is fixed cost, basically.
Rate base is the investment. So it's anything, any capital item that the utility spends money on.
But doesn't include the cost of power.
Does not include the cost of power. Right. That would be in the expenses. That would be in the operating expenses.
The rate base is in what time frame?
The rate base, this is all the test year of 2019.
So that's 1 year.
That's 1 year. Yeah. Cost of service studies are done based on a 12-month ended test year. And then you make pro forma adjustments to that test year to try to make it representative of what the year will be going forward.
So what's included in your rate base?
Rate base.
The poles, the pipe.
Rate base is what's on the books in terms of investment in infrastructure. So it's lines, transformers, poles, substations, meters, buildings, if there's any trucks, all that kind of stuff. Anything that's capital.
Okay, so like a transformer is going to, I mean, you're going to have that for more than a year. So do
right.
you, are there standard ways where you say a transformer is going to last, say, 50 years?
Yes, yeah, so.
You know, and therefore, you take the cost of the transformer and divide it by 50, and then that's how much your rate base is every year for that transformer?
It's similar to that. Okay, so how a revenue requirement is generally put together off of a test year is you take pro forma operating expenses, and then you add your financing cost to them. So rate base does not dollar for dollar go into a rate. What dollar for dollar goes into a rate is operating expenses. Rate base has to be financed with either debt, bonds, or retained earnings. In other words, if we have margins, we plow that margin back into paying for facilities, okay?
Margin being the same thing as savings?
Margin being what's left over after you pay expenses.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, so when we have a high margin, that's part of what goes in.
That can be used to fund infrastructure.
Okay.
Okay. But, so what goes into rates is expenses plus the debt service on the rate base. In other words, okay. Interest and principal.
Okay.
So it's operating expenses plus whatever it costs to finance those facilities. So you're partially right in the sense that it's spread out over the financing term.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yeah, and I'll believe you because
I know it's a lot.
The idea.
I know it's a lot to take in, but
I got the idea.
Okay.
I don't want to get further into weeds on that one.
Yes.
Although Pat might want to be.
Yeah.
No, not necessarily. Help me understand these three categories that repeat for residential service, small general service, small commercial.
Okay.
How do we make revenue off of gas heat?
So there's a separate, unique rate for gas heat, electric heat, and heat pump. So in other words, you're charged differently if you're an electric customer that has gas heat versus if you're an electric customer that has all electric versus an electric customer who has a heat pump. The charges are different. And the same is true with general service. So we set the cost of service study because what we're trying to get to is how do we need to change these rates for each class. So we set the cost of service up on unique charges, unique rates. Any other question on this? And I'll come back to it because we're going to talk a little bit about how do you determine fairness? In other words, what does that mean?
I was surprised that you knew if I had gas heat or electric heat in my house.
When you sign up for service, generally they will ask. I don't know exactly the process here, but in most utilities, when you sign up for service, they ask what you have.
Yeah, but they've not asked other times. Anyway, that's indecisive. I was just surprised when I saw that.
Yep. And it's not really all that uncommon to see things like that. So, what are fair rates? I mean, how do we determine that? What does it mean? So, we're going to go back here and look at, because if you notice the first bullet here, we talk about equalizing the class return on rate base. So, according to, utility rate making theory, in a perfect world, which, I've done these for over 30 years, haven't seen one yet, okay? So it's an ideal that we're always trying to get to. But in a perfect world, these would all be 5.53. In other words, that would indicate perfectly fair rates, okay? So what this is telling you is any class with a rate of return above 5.53 is paying a subsidy to any class with a rate of return below 5.53. So that's the first measure of fairness is where are the subsidies, how do we spot them? And, don't be alarmed by it because, like I said, I've done these for 30-some years. You never, ever see a cost of service study with perfectly, the same rates of return. So it's something you're always striving to do, and it's something that every time you change rates, you should look at where the subsidies are and you should try to reduce them. But you're going to be limited by the bill impacts. In other words, to eliminate them, the bill impacts may be very large to some people. So you have to balance the consideration of making the rates more fair with what the bill impacts are. Okay? So the second piece is when you look at a rate, how close are the charges to what the costs are? So, you know, the customer charge, is it recovering all the customer costs, or is some of the customer costs being recovered in some other charge? You know, when you start mixing costs with how it's recovered, you create subsidies inside of costs. Okay? So the cost of service study, remember we talked about when we classify, we separate it between customer-related, energy-related, demand-related, okay? So the cost of service study is going to give us what the cost-based charge needs to be to recover all those customer costs. And it's going to give us what the cost-based energy charge is to recover the energy-related charges. And it's going to give us what the cost-based demand charge should be to recover demand-related costs. Okay. When you mix those, in other words, when you recover a customer cost and an energy charge, let's talk about that briefly. So, you know, let's just take an obvious one, which would be meter reading and billing. You know, clearly that varies with the number of customers, the number of bills you're sending out. If I recover that in an energy charge, somebody who uses a lot of energy will overpay those costs. Somebody who uses a very little amount of energy will underpay those costs. So when you start mixing how you collect the costs, you can create subsidies within the rate itself. So the most fair rate is going to be one that recovers costs according to how it's created on the system.
It's like the time of the movies. Good time of the movies. The only screen you should be looking at.
So this is, you know, a slide basically saying what we just talked about. So in a perfect world, those rates of return would be equalized, and they tell you where the subsidy is. So, billing the costs according to the appropriate charge. So, what's in these charges? So, a customer charge ideally should recover meter reading, billing, customer service, the meter, the service drop, and something called grid access, which the best way to think about grid access is it's access to the electric grid. But at that point, the grid can't deliver any power. Okay, so it's a network thing. But the easiest way to think about it is it includes things like trenching costs. So if you're trenching for underground cable, the cost is really related to how far do they have to trench to get from my house to your house. So it's customer driven. It's not energy or demand driven. It varies with how many customers how far you have to go to pick up the next customer. So that's a grid access kind of cost, okay? The energy charge, really there's nothing in an electric utility system that varies with kilowatt hour usage other than purchase power energy. And if you produce energy, in other words, if you have a power plant, fuel and variable energy. So that's the only cost that varies with energy, and in a very pure rate, that's all that should be in the energy charge. Demand costs are purchase power demand, the distribution capacity you have to build, in other words, the conductor, the poles, the transformers, that kind of stuff, and the transmission capacity that you have to build. So that's what goes in a demand charge. Now, you'll notice when we get down to rates, that residential rates, some small commercial rates, don't have a demand charge. So in that situation, the demand costs are more appropriately recovered in the energy charge.
Can I just ask, when we say power purchase energy, that's the energy that we generally purchase from the network MISO that we're on? Is that?
In various contracts.
In various contracts, like the coal, like the sites and coal. And does that also include like our wind or solar power?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why it's just called power purchase energy.
Yeah. And generally, those contracts, not always, but generally they'll have two components. In other words, they'll have an energy charge,
right,
and they'll have a demand or a capacity charge.
Okay.
So the demand or capacity charge would be down on that bottom line, and the energy charges through that contract would be in the energy. Okay, so let's talk about the PCA mechanism, because one of the proposals is to add what's called a power cost adjustment mechanism. And so what is a power cost adjustment mechanism? So it's a mechanism basically that captures changes in purchase power costs from the base year that you build into base rates. So what we're proposing is to use 2021 as that base year, and the PCA mechanism would capture any change plus or minus from that 2021 base level of cost. So that's in a nutshell what a PCA mechanism does.
And a quick question for staff. This is kind of like that fuel adjustment that you brought up last fall, because when we saw the increase, we have never pulled that trigger that we have pulled that lever that we have ability.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a mechanism to be able to recover that revenue without having to dip into our cash reserves to cover those costs.
Right. And you mentioned at the beginning, which I don't think last week when we had talked about electric rates 101, you mentioned that our debt ratio last year was major impact with why we were not a one-to-one. You meant earlier today.
Right, yes, the 0.79.
Yeah.
We think is because of we had to dip into our cash reserves for that power purchase, and that's what caused the debt coverage.
Okay.
The $22 million.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the,
yeah.
The more than $30 million, actually.
Okay,
yeah.
$30
million. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So if you do a power cost adjustment, is that per month, or is that spread over?
It's generally calculated each month.
And then is that reflected in the bill that month? It's not like spread over 12 months or spread over a longer period. It's a month by month.
It's a month by month. Yeah.
Sort of like what I see on my Ameren bills.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, they've probably got a fuel adjustment clause.
They do, actually.
Yes.
I saw that. I looked at my
bill
after Energy 101 that I had last week.
Yeah.
Really?
And it does exactly the same thing. It captures, in other words, when they build rates, they'll put a level of fuel cost in the rate, and then that mechanism will capture changes from what they put in the rate. So if they put 2.5 cents into the rate and it goes up to 3, they'll bill you a 0.5 cent.
Okay.
If it drops down to 2, you'll get a 0.5 cent credit.
Okay.
So this works very much the same way that this does.
And this is somewhat different, though, than the fuel adjustment from 1990 or whatever it is that we've never used, because that was just a fixed number that was not really reflective of what the actual
number that was there in the late 90s.
Would we be changing the mechanism so that it would flow in an upward and downward fashion versus a fixed rate?
Yeah.
Whatever. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so, you know, you guys aren't regulated, but these are very, very common in regulated jurisdictions, and the criteria regulators use to determine whether you can have a standalone mechanism to recover cost is based on these three principles. In other words, is the cost large? The purchase power costs are large. Does the cost vary over time? And yes, they do. As you saw in 2022, you know, it can have dramatic changes from year to year. And is the cost largely out of the control of the utility, which it is. In other words, you're at the will of the market in some instances. So you see a lot of these type of mechanisms across the United States because it meets the criteria that's generally used to determine can you have a mechanism in general to recover a specific cost as opposed to just getting it through a rate. Now, the benefits of it is it's going to protect your margins. In other words, it's going to protect that cash reserve amount. It's going to protect your debt service coverage ratio. It's going to protect from fluctuations in purchase power costs. So if power costs go up, it's going to follow. If it goes down, it's going to follow. So either direction. And another important one, in my opinion, is it ensures that customers ultimately pay the out-of-pocket cost for purchase power. In other words, if you try to build purchase power into base rates with no mechanism, then you've got to base it on a forecast or you've got to base it on something. And that something, 9 times out of 10, is going to be wrong. So the customer is going to end up either paying more purchase power costs than they should or they're going to pay less purchase power costs than they should, depending upon the error of what you've built into the rate. So the mechanism ensures on the customer side that what they pay is what you pay. So there's no markup, there's no nothing. They pay what you pay, which I think is an important benefit of the mechanism. So generally how it would work is the council would approve the mechanism itself. In other words, you need to be comfortable with what it's doing, and you would approve the mechanism. And then whatever the mechanism calculates would automatically be billed. In other words, they wouldn't come here each month and say, can you approve this credit or can you approve this charge? It would be, you approve the mechanism, and then whatever the mechanism calculates automatically gets billed. And the calculation, which we've already talked about, is done monthly.
Can you walk me through that? Because when I was looking at other ones, I mean, isn't that kind of awesome? More of a, I guess if you're setting on a year and we're looking at it, doesn't that give us more instability with customers knowing what to expect? Whereas, like, if you have an annual, if it's, you know, I'm trying to see, like, if it's up above a certain whatever, we can use the fuel adjustment and it's expected to be at this rate. And then the next year, you know, I mean,
can I ask a related question, I think?
Yeah, monthly?
Well, that might get to this, you tell me.
Are you just going to ask the same question, but in a manly voice?
Maybe. Oh, I hope not. I guess the question that occurred to me was, with the recent purchase that we had to do and what we had to pull from revenues, if we had had this in place, what kind of impact would that have had on customers in a given month during that same period? Is that, mm-hmm. isn't that sort of?
It's a good question too, but it's not the same.
It's not the same, but I think it's sort of associated. Yeah.
I don't think would we have had $22 million though that we would have had to pull if we'd been doing this adjustment every month? I mean, was this because we ended up in the weeds or just because that month was so much more?
You would not have had to appropriate money for that. In other words, the mechanism, whatever 2022 did, the mechanism would have followed. So as it went up, it would have incorporated itself into bills. And as it came back down, it would incorporate itself into bills. So it will follow what purchase power costs do.
Okay. But we were behind, I think. Weren't we in paying for our power in 2022? I want to look at Erin because she's just started.
Well, behind. We were going to run out of.
But where did you get the original appropriated funds?
Budget.
And So that's different than people paying their bills every month? The appropriated money?
Well, but I guess what I'm wondering is, if we'd had this in place, would customers have experienced like a 25% bump month over month because of the high expense of power? And I apologize to Barbara for stepping on her question. I'll restate it in a manly voice. If you want.
We have it coming up in here.
So okay.
What would have happened?
Yep.
Implemented
okay.
October 1 to 8, but definitely go back and do 22 if you want to see.
Okay. Now, does any of that answer your question?
No, because when you first were talking about this, I was looking into other municipal electric utilities, and so like Austin Energy has a fixed rate adjustment rate that they have for the year, and it doesn't seem to change with the month. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I was wondering, and I don't know how theirs works out. They obviously have more extreme summers than we do, but
I know where you're coming from.
Yeah.
So I can address that. So there's. As usual, there's lots of ways to skin a cat. Okay, so there's
really bad metaphor.
There's
sit next to me and say that.
There's different mechanisms that calculate this. Okay, and they all ultimately do the same thing, but some are more accurate than others. So most of them have a true up at the end of the year, which this one does too. Okay, so. If you do an annual one, generally what you do is you'll forecast the year and you'll say, okay, we think purchase power costs are going up a half a cent. So we'll bill a half a cent. You get to the end of the year, because there's no fluctuation, you get to the end of the year and it didn't really do what you thought it was going to do. So you've got this big mismatch at the end of the year that you've got to roll back into next year's mechanism and bill on top of it, whether that's a credit or a charge, okay? This one is done monthly, and it still starts out forecasted, but because it's calculated monthly, it corrects itself as it goes through the year, so when you get to the end, the mismatch isn't going to be as big. So it's a balance between trying to have a reasonably smooth charge or credit over the course of a year with also having something that's fairly accurate. The longer you go without changing the charge or credit, the less accurate you're going to be when you have to true it up at the end of the fiscal year.
Okay.
So this one I think is a good balance between those two things. You can go more one way and more the other way. Some people, instead of doing like a 12-month forecast, some people will do one single month calculation at a time. That will swing a cent and a half, 2 cents as you go through the year, because as you go into the summer, come out of the summer, go into the winter, come out of the winter, you get those seasonal changes, it creates huge swings because the kilowatt hours swing. But it's extremely accurate over a 12-month period, but people don't generally like it because it does fluctuate all over the place. So what we tried to do is pick one that balanced those two considerations. This one is fairly smooth over the course of a year. In other words,
and it's seasonal based. It looked like from your examples and your presentation.
No, it's not really seasonal based.
I thought I was looking at like December was the more different than the January, or I'm sorry, the fall ones. Sorry. When you get into your examples,
okay.
It might be better.
Yes, you may be looking at the examples, but the calculation really is looking at a 12-month fiscal year and comparing it to what did we collect in revenue for purchase power costs. So are we high, are we low, and then it's dividing that difference over the remaining kilowatt hours in the year.
Okay.
So it's constantly correcting itself.
Okay.
And I'm explaining the slides that's coming up, but But basically, what you do is you start out with a forecasted year, and then as you get actuals, you replace the forecast with actuals. So when you get to the end of the year, it's 12 months actual.
Okay.
And it's simply comparing two numbers. It's comparing what are my power costs and what did I collect from customers for purchase power cost in the rates. And it's trying to true that up, force it to match each other.
You do that every month. So like February of 2021 compared to February of 2023 or 2024.
Well, it'll be the fiscal year. So you'll take the 12 months into October. Is it October?
October.
You'll take the 12 months into October.
Right.
And you'll start out with a forecast of what we think power costs are going to be.
And that's taking an average of your 12 months.
No, it's month by month.
It is month by month.
Forecast. And then as you get
the actual information.
November, you'll take November's forecast out, put November's actual in, and recalculate it. So you do it every single month. You replace a forecast month with an actual, forecast month with an actual. So as you work your way through the year, you're ending up eventually with all 12 months actual. And that's when you do your true.
How often do you reset your base cost?
Every time you change rates. So anytime you have a rate increase, you reestablish the base.
So the annual base, 21. So
every time,
a year from now, it would be based on the 22.
So now if you do another study in 3 years and change rates, you would change the base. So it's whenever you go through this process and change rates. And you would recalibrate the base. Now you can, if you went like 10 years, let's say, and never changed rates, you can roll that into base rates at some point in time and then reset it so that it starts out again at zero or something close to zero. But that's fairly rare because usually, people are changing rates every 3 to 5 years, and they just do it then. So I think we've already talked about everything on these slides, but this last one is just kind of the basic underlying formula. So we're taking purchase power costs for the fiscal year minus the revenue that we're collecting from customers for purchase power. So it's the revenue in base rates and the PCA factors that you bill. And then we're dividing it by expected sales. So we're trying to force those two to match each other. So that's just the basic underlying formula. And like I said, all these mechanisms pretty much do that. In other words, this one isn't unique. It's just it's what I call a declining balance method for doing it, as opposed, you can do 12 months rolling averages, you can do monthly. I mean, there's lots of ways to do it. Lots of ways to do it. And then here are some of the examples that they put together.
We've got up here 25th percentile, 75th percentile, 90th percentile. So if you look at the kilowatt hours of like the 90th percentile, there's only 90% of the customers use less than those kilowatt hours. So we're trying to go with your low, medium, high users. And we selected just the gas heat. Just as an example, the other residential users would be similar to this. And the most customers we have are the residential gas customers. So that's what the different percentiles are the kind of the low, medium, and high users. And this is what if we had started this in October 1st of this fiscal year, this is what we calculated the PCA would have been
for the months of October, November, December, January, and February.
And so, so what this is telling us is that
on a monthly bill,
electric for your power purchase costs more for y'all to purchase electricity in October, November, December, and then it didn't cost you as much in January, February. So that would have been a fuel adjustment for us paying less.
It wasn't as much as what we predicted.
Right. Well, I guess. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yep. And then you'll adjust for actual, or no, that isn't actual, is what you're saying.
Right.
Okay.
But when you get to the end of the fiscal year and you have 12 months actual, mm-hmm. you'll have, you know, X dollars of purchase power cost, X dollars that we recovered through base rates mm-hmm. and these charges and credits, and you'll compare those two numbers for the final time. And then any difference, you roll into next year's. So it trues it up.
You don't write a check to the customer saying you overpaid last year.
They just credit you.
Yeah. No. So it ultimately over time is dollar for dollar matching.
Yeah, electric sends you a check. He gets a check.
A PCA charge like for $2.06 there for October, I have an idea. Percentile, that's what the cost is, not $2 per kilowatt hour.
No, it's the 0.001508 cents per kilowatt hour. So if they used a 1365.
Right.
That's the average use for the 90th percentile in October.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, notice these are the same in all three examples. Those are the charges per kilowatt hour, and then that's the kilowatt hours used.
Okay.
So I was surprised how I was expecting larger numbers here, especially mm-hmm. when talking about the $30 million last year.
Well,
so, I mean, this mechanism would have recovered the $30 million throughout the year, $2 at a time?
The value that
was in
those months would have been marked. It would have been more than 0.25 cents per kilowatt.
We didn't account for the 2022 in this. We pretended we were starting from zero.
Yeah.
So, yes, that would be... I don't know how large because we didn't do it, but they would be bigger than this.
Well, I guess that's Nick's question. I guess my question, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, in a worst case scenario, what are we talking about?
We could run that 22, and you can distribute it, and you can see what 22 would have been and what the true up for this year would have been.
That's why we're using 2021 for your baseline, though, right?
Correct.
Right. Because that we felt like that was an anomaly in 2022, and the power purchase prices have come back down after that.
Yes.
1 or 2 months of out of control.
Yes.
So when communities who have this in place have something like that happen, from your experience looking at other communities that have this, do they have anything that there's like a threshold, like a maximum, like it can't, the way that they've done it can't go above, that's when you do have to dip into because it's viewed as an anomaly and it's not normal, you know what I mean? It's not the sort of thing that then immediately is passed on to customers. I mean, it is, but
I wondered the same thing.
It depends on, believe it or not, it depends on the utility. In other words, I've had utilities where they've had, you know, some extreme happen, and the staff gets together and says, you know, maybe we should recommend not passing 100% of this through, and we'll fund it another way. Okay, so that does happen. That does happen.
And it's probably just in an administrative rule or policy procedure or something to give them that this is what our expectations are.
You could do it that way. I mean, you could certainly come up with a, you know, some kind of threshold above which, you know, you don't want to go above. You know, we'll fund it a different way. But typically what I've seen is it's generally led by the staff being uncomfortable with what they're seeing in the escalation of the rate. So they'll try internally to come up with, you know, how can we mitigate this in some way that makes financial sense? And then they'll has to deviate from what you've approved. In other words, you've approved a mechanism. Here's what the mechanism's calculating, but we don't want to bill all of this. So that's, in my experience, that's generally what happens. It's not, generally when they're approved, there's not like a maximum or something that's put into the language. But, you know, that could potentially work.
Nick, you had a thing.
Well, yeah, I guess I just want to interject here that I hear what you're saying about fairness, and I think I get that. But I'm also thinking about what's equitable. And that's the reason I asked the question about what would have happened. And so what you're describing, I think, is something I would want to see in that kind of circumstance. Mm-hmm. Because for people who are lower income residences, that increase, you know, this is only $2. I'll just tell you there are homes, there are residents in our city who would have trouble with that. But if it's a significantly higher than that, it's all the more problematic for those households. So that's really where my question comes from in terms of what the actual impact would have been in that case. To hear that there might, in that case, at least the staff might look at that and say, let's see if we can do this a different way. That's good. I don't know whether we need to include that in.
If you hadn't paid over $30 million in extra power last year, we probably wouldn't be as particular, but.
Yeah, right.
Because
right.
This example is not from that. Yeah.
Yep. I understand. Okay. Any other questions before we move on? Because we're going to get away from PCA here.
Okay.
Okay.
30
yeah,
more slides.
Oh, we do have one more.
This is an impact to the wastewater treatment plant if we'd have implemented that. So you'd see an additional $1,000 a month at the beginning of the year, but then we start to have a credit.
So this is an indication of industrial customers.
Industrial customers. I think we have, is it 37 industrial customers? And the wastewater treatment plant is one of the top 10 energy users. So of the industrial class. So 28. Okay. So just to give you, it's on the higher end is what I'm trying to point out. But.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, how much do we need?
How much you need, right. So what the model suggests is $8.3 million increase, which is about a 6.9% overall increase. And how that increase was determined was based on a financial model, and this includes having a PCA. So this assumes that there's a PCA mechanism in place, okay? So the rates we've designed and the revenue requirement that we've calculated make the assumption that the PCA is going to be approved. If it's not, it'll be a different number. Okay? So the criteria we used in order to calculate that $8.3 million is we didn't want to raise rates again for 3 years. Okay, so that's the first criteria. We wanted margins to be positive in each of the 3 years. We wanted the cash reserve target to be met in each of the 3 years. And debt service coverage above 1.2 in each of the 3 years. Now, I will tell you this, the debt service coverage did not come into play. In other words, it was always above 1.2, it never triggered a need to increase the amount of the increase. The other two did. The cash reserve target and having positive margins is what ultimately drove the $8.3 million.
How positive should your margins be?
Just above zero. In other words, we didn't put a minimum on them. It was above zero.
Okay, so one of those first slides was 5.53. Is that?
Yeah, that was 2019.
Was that too high, too low?
No. No, that was fine. That was acceptable. This will be 24, 25, 26 is what we're talking about. So fiscal year 24, fiscal year 25, fiscal year 26. So in the financial model that we used, in other words, that $8.3 million is calculated, it's the amount necessary to meet those targets today.
So that amount of $8.3 million and the 6.9% increase is over a three-year period? Or what? Are we talking about a 6.9 increase?
We're talking about a 6.9% increase.
In 2024, over that three-year period.
July 1st.
And then it stays the same for the next 3 years.
Right, it stays the same. The model, what we tried to do is calculate an amount where we didn't anticipate another rate increase till 2027. So if that lowers, then it moves up the next rate increase to 2026 or 2025, depending upon, you know. So
if what lowers?
I'm saying if you do something less than 8.3 million,
okay.
Because like I said, the criteria that we used was no increase or expected increase until 2027.
Okay.
So the idea is the 8.3 million gets you to 2027, and it gives you positive margins each year. It meets your cash reserve targets each year, and it meets your debt service coverage requirements each year. So that's the idea behind it.
Do you have an example of what that rate increase is?
Yes, I've got, for every class, I've got.
Okay.
There's 53 slides, Betsy. They're going to.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You've got,
there's going to be more screenshots.
You've got a long way to go.
I'll try to interrupt as often.
Oh, that's okay. Any questions, just feel free.
I guess I have one. Before you get too much farther, last year when we were talking about fiscal year 23 budget, one of the conversations we had was about the lack of rate increases and its effect on our bond rating, and the fact that we had not been doing small incremental raises over the past, you showed 4 years without a rate increase. So you to say we're not going to do it again for three, I'm kind of like, well, hold on a second. I thought we were talking about doing, potentially starting a schedule of sorts.
Okay.
Where it was not as hard, heavy lift, and then it was consistent.
This gets back to what Aaron talked about earlier. In other words, there was lots of discussion and decision-making that led to these criteria. So one of the discussion points early on is, what do you like? Because
clean some electricity that's cheap.
Yes. Some companies that I work with, they like small annual increases, okay? Some companies that I work with think that if every single year you're raising rates, it's a bad look. So they prefer a larger increase, and then we don't have to touch rates for 3 years or whatever the case may be. So we had the discussion as to which approach do you want to take. And what was decided upon is we prefer the approach of one increase, and then we don't have to go back for annual increases every year.
And this went through Water and Light Advisory Board recommendation as well? Okay. Do you have a question?
That was my question. When you say we, does that include the advisory board?
Yes. So this is showing 24, 25, 26 after the 8.3 million rate increase. And So this is your debt service. And like I said, it never really came into play. This is your cash reserve target. And this is where the cash reserve ended up. And I don't think we have margin. Yeah, oh, there's margin. And so there's your net margins.
So not to start at the bottom of your slide, but your debt coverage ratio, I thought we wanted to be 1.2.
At least 1.2.
At least.
Okay, well.
Got three targets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could you explain the slide?
So your debt service coverage ratio, and I don't know, do you know what it was in?
Well, that was water and the liquid.
Well, and that's 2023, which is the current year we're in.
But generally, your debt service coverage ratios have been on the electric side above 1.2. In other words, they hadn't fallen, and I don't know what they did in 2023 because I don't have 2023 actuals. But typically, if you look, 2022 backwards, they've been above 1.2. So when we projected this going forward, they never really approach 1.2 until you get several years out into the future, beyond 2026.
Yes.
So just bottom line, in 2019 we had a net margin of almost $14 million. We're projecting a net loss that almost $500,000 for this year, hence the need for the rate increase. Mm-hmm. And the rate increase, we're seeing these largely because of increases in costs related to purchasing power, to operating and management, to all the things, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you've got significant CIP budgets. Mm-hmm. And these have been pared back from what they were. But you've got significant CIP budgets coming, and there's some out into the future that's beyond this three-year period that's, significantly larger than these. So but anyway, this just shows that we meet all three criteria. And like I said, the staff reduced the CIP, and this also includes AMI, which is important. So, and the AMI in those CIP numbers is $8 million per year.
And we are putting that in the CIP, but we're not bonding for that. That's the recommendation.
Yes.
And the AMI impact on the rate increase, even though it's significant expenditures, was not that large. It was around $400,000. So in other words, that $8.3 million becomes around $7.9 million if you take AMI out. So it wasn't a massive amount of money. So we didn't do a full rate design on without and with. Okay. So what we tried to do with rate design, and that's what we're getting to here, is we tried to improve the fairness of the rates. In other words, we tried to reduce subsidies. We could not eliminate them because the bill impacts would have been too large. So we're talking about just reducing subsidies, not eliminating subsidies. So one of the ways to do that, you know, if you remember, in a perfect world, you want those rate of returns to be the same. So in order to move those closer together, we increased the classes with low rates of return more than classes with high rates of return. In a lot of studies, we will actually take high rate of return classes and not increase it at all, and we'll spread all of the increase to low rate of return classes. In this case, we thought the bill impacts was too much to do that. So we actually increased all classes irrespective of the rate of return, but we increased the low rate of return classes more than the high rate of return classes. And then in the individual charges, we tried to move those more toward what the cost of service said they should be. And again, we didn't go all the way, and you'll see that when we get into the charges, but we did try to improve the fairness of the rate by moving all those toward cost of service.
Just as a quick example, so it was a low rate of return class on that rate adjustment, the base on the side. Those were the ones that were the...
Below 5.53.
Okay.
So the negative ones, there was like four.
Like that dusk to dawn one, it's like negative 19.
Yeah,
yes.
I saw that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So, like I said, it includes the PCA, or we're assuming that it will include the PCA. And it should, these rates should increase the revenue stability for the utility. In other words, there'll be less volatility due to weather fluctuations and those kinds of things. And, you know, the same thing will be true for your customers. In other words, there'll be less bill volatility from month to month. And like I said, we tried to balance, you know, affordability with the financial objectives that we had set up. So it'll be a July 1, 2023 implementation is what we're asking for. And one of the things we did just to try to get a sense of what the bill impacts are going to be is we looked at customers receiving energy assistance and what their usage patterns are. And keep in mind, you don't know the income of your customers. In other words, all we know are the ones that are getting assistance. So you know, I don't know anything about the ones that aren't getting assistance because, you know, utilities don't know the incomes of their various customers. But the ones that are receiving assistance are typically higher users than ones not receiving assistance. Okay? And that'll be important as we get into some of the rate recommendations. So the impact, I don't know how familiar you are with the rate design that you have in place, but it's what's called an inclining block structure. In other words, as you use more energy, the cost per kilowatt hour increases. Okay? So for people receiving assistance, that's having a negative impact on those customers because they tend to be higher users than people who are not receiving assistance. So one of the things that I'll point out when we get there is I compressed the charge differentials on the blocks to try to mitigate some of that impact a little bit. So in terms of the increase by class, this is what it looks like. So this is current rates, proposed rate revenue, and the increase, which is our $8.3 million. And then these are the percentage increases by class. And like I said, I increased all classes some, even if they had a high rate of return, just because the bill impacts wouldn't allow us to go zero on these, because we would have to spread this into these other categories, which we felt like would create bill impacts that we didn't really want.
So you can see Dust to Dawn got increased 65%.
Yes. And even though it's a high percentage, because it's lighting, it's typically like $4 a month or $6 a month or something like that. So it's a high percentage, but not a high dollar. And you'll see right here that they're still negative. So in spite of a 65% rate of return, see that they were negative by 608,000. So we only captured 200 of the 600,000 that they were negative by.
Since you're total at the bottom of your proposed rate of return on rate base is 10.12%, is that what we now want all of them to be if they were even?
Yes, if it was, if the rates were perfect all the way up and down, this would be 10.12 all the way up and down.
Okay.
And like I said, I've never seen that.
Right.
I've seen some that are very, very tightly grouped within a percent of each other. But that's people who have been working at it for years. In other words, they've been taking each rate increase and they've been addressing the subsidies over time, and they've gotten to the point where they have a very, very tight group.
Okay, wait, quick clarification. You just said 10.12 would be ideal. Like, would it be ideal, or wouldn't, like, you wanted these to all be, I mean, return on rate base, ideal is that you're covering? I guess I'm just...
Ideal in terms of fairness is...
They all have the same
percentage. Every class rate of return should be the same. So it would be the 10.12 all the way up and down through here.
And that's the one that was 5.53 on your others.
Yes.
Right. So
yes.
Whatever it is, it should be...
So this
is the same all the way up and down.
This is what they were in the cost of service study.
Oh, look at that.
And after we add the proposed rate increase, this is what we expect them to be.
Wow.
So I guess that's my question from earlier, is why is 10.12 a better number than 5.53?
Well, let me answer that two ways. First, you got to keep in mind this is 2019. Okay, because so this isn't the financial model, and this gets a little confusing a little bit. This is the cost of service study, not the financial model, which goes out many, many years. So the 10.12 is not as important as the grouping or the relative numbers. In other words, the 10.12 is calculated against something that's 4 years old. But it's the cost of service study, so that's the only way, that's the only mechanism we have for calculating it, is the cost of service study. Ideally, you know, COVID kind of derailed us and all that kind of stuff, but ideally, you want all this completed within, like, you know, a year, and then the cost of service study is the information that you're using to calculate these numbers are more current with where you are today, as opposed to, you know, something that's 4 years ago. So keep in mind, this is four-year-old revenue that we're calculating this against, whereas the financial model that determined the $8.3 million is current, okay? But the financial model doesn't have it by residential gas heat, residential electric heat, residential heat pump, so I can't do this calculation off of the financial model, which is more current. All I have is the cost of service study that we did back in 2019. So what's more important is these numbers are closer together here than they are here. In other words, we've brought them a little bit closer together, so we've reduced the subsidies from where we started. And it will be, you know, if you decide that you want to try to do this consistently, you know, it's a you know, it will be a long process in order to get those balanced out to where they're very uniform up and down through there. But same thing as before. Anybody who's above 10.12 here is paying a subsidy to anybody below 10.12. But the subsidies are less than what they were when we started. So let's look at the last slide here before we get into the actual rate changes. So these are your current customer charges for each rate schedule. This is what the cost of service study says they should be, okay? And we didn't go all the way to cost on these, but we're trying to move the charges more toward cost. And one thing to understand with customer charges, though, is the cost is still there. So what's happening is you charge $16.31. And that $4.5 million that you're not recovering in the customer charge is in the energy charge. So the energy charge is higher than what it should be. The customer charge is lower than what it should be. And so it creates non-fair rate design, and it creates more volatility month to month because of weather variation, because it's all in the energy charge instead of the fixed customer charge. So what this shows you is ideally where they should be, and that's not what we're proposing, but it's ideally where they should be. And here is kind of the impact or the potential impact on the financial health of the utility. And what I mean by that is because, in other words, these are the number of bills that gets sent out in each class. This is calculated by 2957 minus 1631 times the number of bills that you send out. So that $4.5 million is the difference in what you should be charging through the customer charge, and now you're getting it in the energy charge, which means it's subject to weather variation. If you have mild weather, that $8.5 million of fixed cost that you need to recover doesn't show up because you're not selling as many kilowatt hours. If you have extreme weather, more than the $8.5 million shows up. So you collect more than you need to on the fixed cost. So aside from the fact that it's customer-related cost and it is not fairly recovered through a kilowatt hour charge, it puts this $8.5 million of cost subject to weather variation on whether you get it, whether you get too much, that kind of thing. So it's just something I wanted to point out to you that we're trying to, you know, we can't completely correct it in one shot, but that's one of the things you'll see as we go through these is I've tried to move the customer charge up to try to compensate for what it should be. So residential gas heat, that's the current rate. So it's 1631 customer charge. You've got three summer blocks. So as you move over 300 kilowatt hours, it gets more expensive. As you move over 750 kilowatt hours, it gets more expensive again. In the summertime, you've got four blocks. So once you exceed 1,250 kilowatt hours, it goes up to 15 cents a kilowatt hour. So if we keep the same rate structure, in other words, we keep the same blocks, what I'm proposing is we go from $16.31 to $22 instead of the $29 and whatever that number was. So we move it up to $22. And then, if you notice, I'm compressing the differences in the blocks. In other words, there's not as much difference between the first block and the last block. And then as an alternative, we could eliminate a block and go from 3 to 2 or from 4 to 3. And this bottom shows the number of customers, average usage, average bill, and then the average monthly increase.
So what's the advantage of reducing the number of blocks?
Well, there's really no cost basis for it. In other words, your purchase power cost isn't blocked. There's nothing that we know of. There's no data that we have that says the 1,251st kilowatt hour costs 2 cents or a cent and a half, whatever that is, more than the 1,250th. It's arbitrary. Okay? The only justification for inclining blocked rates, and I don't know if you've ever heard the term load factor, but the only justification for inclining block rates would be that as a customer uses more power, their load factor gets worse. We don't really have any data that says that that's the case on your system. So these are, for lack of a better word, they're somewhat arbitrary. There's no cost justification for having inclining blocks. And in fact, in the United States, you don't see a lot of inclined blocks.
Is there a use justification? That
conservation discussion?
Conservation?
That's how we originally...
Okay, let's talk about conservation.
Right, yeah.
Let's talk about conservation. So let's start out with the tail block. Okay, so there's a couple points with conservation. Let's start out with the tail block. So you're charging 15 cents a kilowatt hour. Okay? Your marginal cost, in other words, the cost of a kilowatt hour of electricity that you're buying, is probably 3 cents or something like that. Okay? I can't remember the exact number, but let's say it's 3 cents just for illustration purposes. Okay, so you've got 12 cents of fixed cost in that kilowatt hour that you're hoping somebody doesn't buy. So every time you don't sell a kilowatt hour, you avoid 3 cents of cost and purchase power cost, and then you don't recover 12 cents of fixed cost that you need. Okay, now the second point is broader than that. So if you look at purchase power contracts, you know, we talked before about there's a demand component and there's an energy component, okay? The demand component is based on how much capacity do I need in peak periods. In other words, I've got to buy enough capacity during those peak hours that I can deliver the power. That's a separate thing from kilowatt hour. Okay, so this tells a consumer zero about when can I use power, when is it expensive to use power, when is it not expensive to use power, okay? So what happens with conservation is if I've got, let's say I've got $10 of purchase power demand costs and I sell 1,000 kilowatt hours. So when I spread that $10 over that 1,000 kilowatt hours, it's a penny a kilowatt hour, okay? If the conservation rate design causes you to sell, and I'm jumping to 500 because the math is easy, if it causes you to sell 500 kilowatt hours, now you're spreading that $10 over 500 kilowatt hours, so now it's 2 cents a kilowatt hour. So conservation without peak demand reduction, which this can't give you because there's no price signal for peak demand reduction, actually causes your unit cost to increase. So conservation without any kind of peak demand reduction will increase your unit costs over time as people don't buy kilowatt hours.
So, but if we're going into this discussion around AMI and eventually doing time of use rates, wouldn't we then want to come back to this inverted block structure?
Not an inverted block. You'll want to come back to on-peak, off-peak, if it's an energy rate, you'll want to have a peak period window that's more expensive than the off-peak period window.
Right.
If it's a demand rate, you'll want to have a purchase power demand window that mirrors the demand costs you pay in your contract. So if you incur demand during that peak period window and we have to pay $10 a kW for it, you're going to pay $10 a kW for it. And that sends a price signal that reduces those peak period costs. And then it makes sense.
I think I just feel like a lot of like what you just said, like the customer is not gonna, you know what I mean? Like they're not gonna know, we're not gonna do. Whereas like the conversation we've been having since doing an inverted block structure is this idea. This is not to discount your point about high energy users, those who are seeking energy assistance, because don't get me started on energy efficiency of rental properties. So I guess you mentioned earlier that it's not really used, but like I was just looking at some of our peer other municipal electric utilities, and Austin Energy does do an inverted block. They do the tiered structure as well, where it gets more expensive the more energy you use. But maybe what you're referring to, so Fort Collins does they do a peak, but then they also have an energy efficiency tier charge, which I didn't know if that was the same thing as what we're doing, but just not having three sections to it, if maybe that's kind of the splitting the middle with that.
Do they have AMI? Either Austin or Fort Collins?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's the conversation I've had. It's just that
yes,
I don't know when I'm using these. You know, when I'm at the peak load, I can guess in the middle of the summer that
right.
I'm going to turn my air conditioner off. And
right.
Between 2 and 7, that's probably a good thing. But it doesn't save me money.
Right.
AMI. I can't tell if it saves me money because I don't have any AMI.
Think about it like this. So let's say the hottest day in August, which is probably what you're going to be billed for in August through your capacity charges. Okay, I can use more than 1,250 kilowatt hours in the month of August and use zero on that hottest day during those peak period hours. I can say, you know, you're not going to incur purchase power demand costs because of me because I'm off the peak, and I can still use more than 1,250 kilowatt hours. The inclining block structure doesn't tell me to do that, though. In other words, you've got to have a peak period window that sends a price signal so that they know when, because it's the when that matters. That, you as a consumer, all you know to do is, okay, last month I used 1,500 kilowatt hours. I need to figure out how to use less this month. But that less can come in off-peak hours. That less can come at times where all it does is avoid that 3 cents. It doesn't really save you any capacity charges. So the rate structure, and it's a limitation of energy rates in general. In other words, energy rates without a demand charge is a very limited price that consumers can't react to very well. It's just a limitation of the rate design. We have boatloads of energy rates in the United States because watt-hour meters were inexpensive. Demand meters were very expensive. So as the industry evolved, they spent less money on metering for smaller loads and they put demand meters on very large industrial loads. Okay? AMI has changed that. So AMI makes metering small loads with demand much more cost-effective than what it's ever been before. So what you're seeing in the industry nationwide, as people implement AMI systems, you're seeing much more creative rate designs. You're seeing time-of-use energy rates. You're seeing what's called four-part demand rates. Even on residential, the investor-owned utility where I live, and investor-owned, believe it or not, are kind of behind the game. Investor-owned utility where I live has an optional four-part demand rate for residential. In other words, two demand charges, so purchase power demand and a distribution demand. Okay, that's where the industry is really changing very rapidly right now because of AMI. Because it allows you to do things and be more fair with your rate design than you ever could be in the past, because you can do things that you never could do before.
I'm going to interject real quick, just in the interest of time. the only reason we put that modified block up there was not to start a rate discussion, because what Water and Light Advisory Board recommended was to keep with our existing rate structure. That's what they recommended. We wanted to provide that just as an example, so that you could see that. So I think in the interest of time, let's move forward to look at the different rates. So you can see what the actual monthly bill impact is for the monthly rates. I'm assuming y'all want to focus like on residential. We do have, you know, the other small commercial and industrial, which I think you should see as well. But like to, and there's multiple, you know, there's the gas heat, there's the electric heat and the heat pump heat, but they're pretty similar, really. Well, I guess it shows up there.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's the individual.
So what we tried to do here is kind of pick a relatively low use, something somewhere around the medium, and then a relatively high user, and compare the current bill with the proposed bill. So this proposed current structure is the same blocks you have now. The modified block is getting rid of that one block. So the yellow is what the board recommends. And you can see, particularly in the summer, the effect of compressing the block a little bit, is it's not as big of an increase. Okay, so pretty much the same rate design, different numbers, but pretty much the same rate design for the all-electric class. So these are customers that are all-electric, they don't have gas heat. And you can see the average here is significantly larger, 940 kilowatt hours instead of the 713 or whatever the last slide was. And then if you look at the, you know, like a relatively low user, something around the medium, and then a relatively high user.
The larger ones go down. Proposed current, so I'm looking at your high user, the 19,000 kilowatt hours. You've got your proposed current structure and then your proposed modified block. So you're saying that they would now pay less than they did this year?
And it's because, and if you go back, it's because of this.
They went into the higher.
They pay less on the total bill.
Pay less on the total bill, but it's because these end blocks, in other words, at 1950, you're getting into this very last block, and where I compressed the high to low over the blocks, it's saving those customers money when you get deep into those blocks. Compared to the current bill. Okay. And then this is residential heat pump. And if you notice, by far, your largest average use. And again, you know, same type structure. And then if we look at the low user, medium, high user, Okay. Small general service. And this is gas heat as well. And the blocks are a little bit different on these. If you notice, you've got the first 500 and then everything over 500.
Yeah.
And then 500, 1,000, and then anything over 1,500. But still, you know, same kind of concept overall. And I did not do, because I didn't think we would have time to get through all of them, so I did not do high, medium, and low on the commercial rates.
Good idea.
So this is all electric general service. And what I'm doing is very consistent on all these. In other words, I'm compressing these differences to try to get try to reduce the impact of the inclining log. This is heat pump, general service heat pump. And then this is the demand rate. So this is a general service optional demand rate. And if you notice, it adds an actual demand charge. And that, in theory, should recover distribution capacity costs, purchase power capacity costs. That's the place for those costs. And on this rate, your customer charge was already adequate, so we left it alone. But I am putting the increase, basically most of it, into the demand charge, because that energy charge has more than just purchase power energy in it. And then large general service, again, it has demand charges. And I did increase the customer charge there and then put most of the rest of the increase into the demand charge. Interruptible service. There's only two of these guys, if you notice.
What does that mean?
So with, I don't know exactly what your terms are, but typically with interruptible service, they get a credit or a discount for interrupting their load during peak periods. So in other words, it's a concept. Remember we talked about on residential how you could send a price signal to do that. This is a price signal to get off our peak and save purchase power capacity related costs.
So give us an example of the industries that are
at a peak.
It's rock crushers at the rock quarry.
So on a hot day, we can tell them, can you shut down for a little while until the peak goes down?
So that's your decision. That's... they agree to follow your decision making, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And it saves you cost, and they get a break on the rate because they produce cost savings.
Mm-hmm.
And then industrial, and notice I raised the customer charge again. Most of the rest of the increase is going in the demand charge. And there's 27 of these guys.
So it's storage rate?
Um, Is that your is that your thought, Baba? Is that your
has to do with how the demand rates are different for different seasons. So if you're a winter peak, there's not a lot of air to do with having different demand rates. I think there's probably 2 or 3 customers very close to the interruptible service in terms of the impact to our system. But the idea, of course, is that because you pay a lower demand, you're essentially offsetting the cost.
They're using the battery to do that. In other words, battery storage to do that.
This is just an impact to the wastewater treatment plant, again, as an example. If we were to... I think this is last year's usage at the wastewater treatment plant, what the bill impacts would have been.
And you said the wastewater treatment plant is one of our largest,
one of our larger users
in large industrial.
Yes.
Okay.
This is special outdoor lighting.
Ball fields.
And then dusk to dark. So this was the biggest increase. And then Aaron, I guess.
So I just wanted to summarize what the Water and Light Advisory Board, what their recommendations were. They decided on the $8.3 million annual revenue, and that has to do with implementing this July 1st, as opposed to we thought we might get it implemented earlier this fiscal year, but we are where we are. It also includes the AMI and the staff adjusted CIP, and they were adamant that it meet all these three requirements for the next 3 years. So again, they were the ones that directed that we look at a rate increase that will basically last for 3 years. So that was in their recommendations.
Can I ask a question right there?
Yeah.
The staff adjusted CIP, that means that there are some things we might...
So that means that originally it was the Siemens proposal for the CIP was implemented into this cost of service and everything. And staff went back and looked at that and decided that it was probably a little too ambitious and wouldn't be accomplished in the time frames that they were proposing. So instead, we're trying to propose something that we think we can actually accomplish.
So it is fewer projects than Siemens it was including. In
yeah, we just push the projects out. It's not necessarily fewer. They're just when we fund them. You know, there's no sense funding a project this year that we're not going to be able to actually start paying on for 5. So that was mostly the staff adjusted. And there were some projects we were regularly putting money into that in the last couple of years we hadn't spent that money. And so instead of putting money into it, we decided let's spend some of that money first, and then we can look at putting more money back into that project when we need it. So, again, Water and Light Advisory Board wanted to increase the customer charge to better account for the fixed costs and improve the fairness, and then look at supporting low income through existing programs. They agreed with the 6.9% rate adjustment, hoping that'll last us for 3 years, with the intent that the power cost adjustment method would be implemented. And again, keep the current rate structure to keep it simple to explain. And really the only difference we proposed was to show you that modified rate structure just as a comparison. So, the Water and Light Advisory Board does want us to reevaluate that rate structure after AMI implementation. And I think they said they want us to start the next cost of service study next year. So, so again, this is just a summary of all those points, our goals, but really the next steps, we need you to consider this information, provide guidance to us if we can move forward with the electric rates as we proposed. And then if so, we could bring that back, an ordinance for your consideration, and also the power cost adjustment. If there's certain things you want to see, like if you want to see a threshold on that or something like that, please let us know and we can bring those back for your consideration.
So for next steps, we're obviously 15 minutes before our next council meeting. I don't necessarily know that we'll be able to give you the exact guidance.
Right. Well, and I know Dr. Peters said she'd need some time to think about it as well. So,
Well, I think one thing is in, while we're all here, just to think about, I know we talked about, because there's other discussions within the electric utility that are, I think, part of your the budget questions. Mm-hmm. We might see, I asked Carlin earlier, there's nothing on the April 3rd tree council. So we might, rather than continuing this, I know you all weren't available for to do it again next week, but maybe the April 3rd pre-council to condition this as well as any transmission discussion on April 3rd, if that works for council. Mm-hmm. That's our regular pre-council, mm-hmm. is to kind of maybe give some guidance back on this as well as have the conversation about transmission lines. You'll be in town, all of you. All right, so council feedback on this right now. Questions or thoughts?
Yeah, first impressions are helpful too. The $8 to $12 average increase.
Yeah.
Well,
monthly.
If it's appropriate, I'd really be curious about Water and Light Board. If there's anything, we have several members here, and I wonder if there would be anything that they think might be helpful in us taking all this in.
So David, you're still the chair, I assume.
Yes.
But I do have on that. I'm not going to talk over you on this thing, but. With that, I think because I think my biggest concern is that we are going to say 6.9%, and then like come in 3 years we're going to be like another six, you know, and then I'd be like, why didn't we just do 3 or 2 every incrementally going forward? So I guess if you have any feedback on that.
Yeah, so I think a couple of points on that one. I mean, we talked about phasing, do we want to phase in? I think what we discussed is really this is only 2 fiscal years. It's fiscal year 24 and fiscal year 25 with a little bit of extra in fiscal year 23 to start in July. And so what we discussed is it's not one small increase, it's one big increase, right? Because that's really all of it. I mean, it wouldn't be like we're going to do a small increase or a moderate increase and a small increase. It would be here's a pretty big increase, and then to catch up with what we didn't catch with that increase, here's another big increase. And so we kind of said, instead of the two moderate sized, a large one up front would be better. And especially, I mean, we would love if we could go back in time and do, a 2% increase, 2% increase, 2% increase, or that'd be great. But just kind of where we are, we thought meeting our financial obligations for the purpose of bonding and kind of getting back on track financially was off what we viewed as our priority. Rather than going through this in terms of every year, reevaluating how do we now catch up again. And so we are far behind in some sense. And so, I think that 0.77 is pretty scary to us, given all our financial training. So kind of getting that on track was kind of our number one priority. So that's the one thing. The other thing I'll say is, in terms of your recommendations and how we move forward, we did not make any recommended changes or reevaluations to the rates, in part because we really only have one more crack at it with the consultant in terms of, we want to see this adjustment. And so we wanted to wait until we got feedback from you before we made any recommendations on that, because we really didn't want to kind of move forward and then say, oh no, we can't do it again because we don't have any consultant.
Yeah, great.
On the
yeah.
Tom.
Hold on.
Oh,
you're
fine. On the phase in, we looked at that, and I think it was cash reserve that was not met in that year. Mm-hmm. If we phased it in. So we probably would have had a harder rate increase because we would have tried to adjust that. So
okay.
It really didn't work. We thought that might be helpful
And further on that, really quick, is ultimately we said, you know, doing that phase in and not meeting those requirements just meant that 26 rate increase or 27 or whatever year would be even higher, right? So it's like we're now just pushing off the bigger rate increases to future councils or future residents who are the same as our current residents, right? So it's kind of more pain later, and it's just kind of kicking the can down.
I do not recall what his point was. The other point was one of the reasons we didn't really want to change the structures too much because it was too much all at once, and then we're going to have to do it again
with
AMI. Because AMI is likely to have bolstered that away. It'll give some options, and it just thought it would be too confusing for repairs. Because it'd be two big changes a few years apart. So.
The only thing I would add is that it's important to think about this outside of just the mechanics of the rate increases. There are a few dominoes that have to be pushed over. One is, once we establish the rate increases, we shore up our shortcomings in terms of our debt coverage ratios and the way that we're viewed by investment grade rating companies, which allows us to proceed with water improvements and bond issuance in that area. And that's part of why we didn't want to, we could really get bogged down if we did the work that is necessary, that has to be dedicated for finding a solution for the low-income residents. So that came into every single discussion was, we have to, first of all, identify who constitutes low-income, and then do something separate and outside of this rate recommendation that specifically addresses and is tailored to their needs, so that we don't find ourselves 4 months away still trying to figure out what we should do on that. Meanwhile, everything else that must be done is language. So our recommendation was to proceed with this as is, while we, on a parallel track, address some of these other critical issues that comes from Foster. Yep.
Mayor?
Yeah, Pat?
I just want to follow along with what Tom said. We already have residents that can't afford their utility bills. And they do this crazy shuffle every month of trying to ride their disconnect notice and figure out what bill they cannot, you know, they can skip this month or whatever. So I have listened to Matthew in the Finance Audit and Advisory Committee meetings tell us over and over again that you can't address the low-income population in your rates. You have to do that with an outside program. So I would like to see that, first of all, I do not believe we have sufficient funds in either the cash, the help, or the new program that we, the one that was created with the surplus CARES Act dollars, that was $300,000. So I would be very interested in a conversation with the Water and Light Board and city staff about how we raise the money we have available to not only take the current stress off of our low-income residents, but also to be able to take this additional stress off of them. It really is. We do cause harm, not intentionally, but unintentionally, every month with our folks who just cannot figure, they have no way forward.
That's right. When we began the RFP for this whole process in 2018, when we defined the RFP, this was one of the mandates we agreed as a group when it was the task force. So we can't get to the end and then say, oh, well, we'll figure it out down the road.
Yeah.
This is front.
Well, it has to be simultaneous.
Well,
we're going to pass a rate increase. We have to then show where we're going to put the money and the resources to attend to our existing needs and those expanding needs.
Yeah, Greg.
I was going to say, as we go through this process, it really surprised me that the low-income customers, they were larger users. And then how come they're not doing energy conservation? Are our programs not right?
Yeah, and I'm conscious over the time, so we have 6 minutes until our next. So if you can
one quick note was to say that we had a forecast for 10 years, and so to Mr. Switzer's point is in 2027 the proposed rate increase would be double digits, and so that's one of the reasons why the rate increase now is what it is to, you know, to try to make that one a little bit less, but it's still double digits at this point,
right,
based on our forecast.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so we'll continue the discussion at our April 3rd along with the next part of the conversation for electric utility. All right, we have 6 minutes, 5 minutes now until our next meeting, so I'm going to go ahead and adjourn us. Thank you so much for the presentation. Appreciate meeting you. Absolutely.